Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, Love is in the Air, we crunch the numbers with Dr. Louisa Dillner in a logical and scientific take on romance, an attempt to get to the bottom of questions like, do chat-up lines work? Do opposites attract? And why can't producer Andy get a date? Plus,
13 meters long with a mass of 1.25 tons. It's about the length of a Tyrannosaurus rex.
We speak to the man who discovered the world's biggest snake. It's very highbrow stuff on here. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. We've battled our way through the snow to bring you this podcast. Science correspondent Ian Sample is here. Hello, Ian.
Hello there. Hello.
And The Guardian's James Randerson is also here. James,
hello.
Good
hello.
Shirt, as always.
Oh, there is. I make it my speciality.
Good. The now former Guardian columnist Louisa Dillner is also here in the studio. She's the author of a new book, Love by Numbers, The Hidden Facts Behind Relationships. Louisa, welcome.
Hi.
She's the head of new product development at the British Medical Journal Group and, according to her press release, has a perfect relationship. Fair to say, Louisa, you're like an agony aunt with a scientific footing. Is that about fair?
The columns I wrote were a sort of attempt to answer questions in a rather different way. I think traditionally agony aunts answered questions from their own experience of life and often their own experience of being marital therapists. But the book's really more about trying to provide some evidence.
So the idea was that people would write in with their usual relationship queries, and my boyfriend doesn't like me anymore, or I think my husband is having an affair, that kind of thing. And you would, instead of saying, well, what you need to do is sit down and talk, is go around, look for studies that maybe have analysed this in some way and give them a statistical type answer.
Yeah, well, this started from when I was working at the British Medical Journal, and we were really big on evidence-based medicine. And the idea is that we would help doctors, give doctors information about the latest evidence so that they could make decisions about how to treat patients. And then we actually went on to develop that information for patients so that we had information that would help patients decide what treatments to take based on the best available evidence. And I was on the tube one day and I could hear these women chatting, as you do, and one of them was saying, oh, you know, my boyfriend's left me and, you know, we've been together for 2 years and I wonder whether he's going to come back. You know, he just sort of left, said that the relationship was over. And her friend was saying, oh, I'm sure he will. You know, you've been together for so long. And, you know, just wait and I'm sure it'll be right. And I remember thinking, well, how do you know? You know, what's the evidence that, you know, for that? You're telling somebody to wait. And actually, maybe that's not true.
Did you row in with, well, statistically, 18%
well,
of people
yeah,
do come back?
Well, I didn't know that. So, but it did make me think, is there any evidence out there for this sort of thing? And of course, when you go and look, there's lots of research papers in social psychology journals, and they're the sort of journals that people don't bump into. And actually, in fairness, when you go and look at these papers, they're very long, they're very dense. It's kind of quite hard to pick out a sort of nugget of information. So it's about translating them in a way that people can understand.
So let's go through some of the examples then. So let's go through the whole dating to marriage to their death scenario. So you like somebody, you see them. What kind of help could you give someone who's dating about, from your vast experience of statistical analysis of these things?
I think sometimes the dating thing in some ways is the easiest bit. So, I mean, it's
it really isn't, trust me.
I mean, you start, you know, by meeting somebody, and the common places are meeting through friends at work,
in the gym, and
in
pubs.
Well, that depends. It's a good question about that, because it's not a bad place to meet somebody, but if it goes wrong, it's a terrible place to meet somebody. And what made me laugh when I was looking through the research is that people are so lazy that the chances of you meeting somebody on your own floor for a relationship are massively higher than even the floor below.
Well, we've just moved offices. There's a huge number of people. We're sitting next to sport, so I'm not sure there's going to be
any. I think there's not a lot of dating potential there. And similarly, you are quite likely to meet people through friends. And one of the things that I often used to say when advising people was, you know, tell your friends that you're looking for somebody because they're pretty well placed to try and network and find people for you. And of course, you don't meet anyone sitting in your front room.
Okay, so you're on a date with someone. Is there any advice you can give someone about whether they like you or not? Are you talking about specific individual things about body language and things, or is it more about what kind of strategies, I mean?
Well, the evidence about what strategies you should adopt when you meet somebody are that you should be yourself. I mean, that's what you have to be. And to try and impress somebody too much or to be rather sort of desperate is clearly sort of off-putting. And some of these studies are around speed dating, for example. There's been a huge amount of studying around speed dating because it's very easy to look at what sort of things appeal. And of course, first of all, it is the, you know, how tall is somebody? How good looking is somebody? How much do you think somebody might earn? It is those sort of rather ghastly, sort of basic, sort of evolutionary things that you're interested in. But then it is also about sort of humour and personality, and those are things that matter. And I think being able to convey that is very useful. I mean, for women, there was this big thing for a long time that you couldn't be a smart woman and get a date. And there's quite a lot of evidence from the States looking at the amount that women earn correlated with, you know, their relationship status that shows that that's not true. So sometimes you can think that something's going to go against you and it doesn't. And I did have this terribly sad question once from this woman saying, you know, should I act stupid to get a date? And you think, well, when are you suddenly going to, you know, not be stupid? Like, you know, pretend you've been away for some sort of, you know, short degree course.
there was an interesting question also that I read in your book about whether men supposedly prefer blondes to brunettes or not. And what I enjoyed about that, the answer to that was, well, obviously there's no actual necessarily an answer to that now. But the fact is that perhaps men do prefer blondes because they stood out more on the savannah. Is that right?
Well, that's what they say, isn't it? No, that's what they say. They say that in sort of more ice age times, you could see sort of blonde hair more easily than brown.
So you basically only attracted to what you can see.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it gives you more of a fighting chance, doesn't it? You know,
James.
There is an interesting question with that. Is that culturally specific, that supposed preference, or you know, does that apply the world over? Presumably
apparently
not.
That diversity was more common in sort of northern Europe, so that was really sort of only an issue there. And what was interesting about the study is that, you know, men said, oh, I really like, they sort of went for women who had the same colour hair as them. That's not the evolutionary studies, but the more recent studies. But still, blondes were attributed with being, you know, sort of ditzy, you know, but also attractive, but not necessarily the sort of person you'd want to go out with.
What you were saying earlier on about the love on different floors of the building now explains why I've seen Andy sharking around on the fourth floor. I was wondering what he was doing up there.
That's the management floor, isn't it?
That's where the cash is. That's right. I just wanted to ask a slightly sort of devil's advocate question, really. I mean, from your background at the BMJ, I mean, obviously you're used to dealing with, you know, really hardcore evidence-based medicine. Some of the sort of studies on this kind of topic in those social psychology journals are perhaps a little bit flaky. Did you have to do a massive kind of filtering job to filter out those things that were, you know, although they purported to show a certain thing, actually were not useful studies?
I mean, what I try to do in the book is to give some qualifying comments about the evidence. But that's quite a hot topic in social psychology because there's a big awareness that a lot of the study designs are not very good. For example, they'll often use their undergraduate students, and is an undergraduate from Berkeley, you know, like a sort of 40-year-old woman from Streatham? I mean, probably not. And also, the studies tend to take sort of snapshot in time. So they're not longitudinal studies that will follow somebody up and see what's happened to them. They go, right, that's how it is now. There's also a huge sort of fallout from these studies, and you never know whether people have dropped out because they're happy or they're unhappy. And often there isn't a sort of statistical analysis that allows for that. But at the end of the day, you know, you can't have randomised controlled trials where you go, you know, you're blinded, you're going to fall in love and marry this bloke, and you're going to have kids with that bloke, you're going to divorce. I mean, you can't do a randomised control study, but you probably could. And I think there's quite a lot of pressure that social psychologists are putting on themselves to do the best studies that they can. So apparently sort of less than 10% of studies are longitudinal studies where you follow somebody up. But then I guess you'd have to start with, you know, here you are at 10, what sort of relationships are you going to have? And that's because there are so many variables. I mean, if you put somebody on a drug, you can say, well, you're this age, you've got this condition. Mm. And even in drugs, people worry that they don't take account the trials of people who have more than one condition. But here you've got somebody whose parents might have split up. That's quite a big indicator for the likelihood that you're going to stay with somebody. There'll be people who have got stress in their jobs who might, you know, drink quite a lot. The couples who've got little kids. I mean, all these things sort of impact. It's quite hard to separate out.
Well, with all those caveats, then let's go to a couple of more of examples of the kinds of things you were tackling in the book. So these classic questions, things like, do chat up lines work? Is there a thing called a 7-year itch? Let's go into those.
Okay, so I think chat up lines is interesting, okay, because there were, and these are survey studies, so they're not, you know, fantastic studies, but it's quite a simple thing to find out. I mean, what one of the studies did was it provided a sort of hypothetical scenario, and those are my least favourite, because what you're saying to somebody is, what do you think you'd do, not what would you do, and then watching them do it. But what they did was they asked undergraduates the sort of chat-up lines that were most successful, and the ones that worked were ones that were a question. So if you sort of said, well, you know, hi, what do you think about this, or, you know, what's your... The examples they gave were from speed dating again, and one was, what's your favourite pizza topping, or... You know, but so, apparently that really works. You can use that, okay?
but sort of saying, better than rowing in with, you know, the Israeli Palestine crisis or something like that.
Yeah, I think take it down a bit intensity wise, or, you know, so asking a question that's sort of open, that gives somebody a chance to respond, rather than sort of wailing in with something that's a statement, is better. Then one of the scenarios involves somebody saying, I own this bar, do you want to dance? And clearly that went down quite well, apparently, because it showed not only could he dance, which is unusual, but also that he owned the bar.
But asking someone to dance doesn't necessarily mean you can dance, surely.
What if that's not true? Well, what if you don't happen to own a bar?
Well, yeah, so it's a hypothetical question. Actually, there's a whole literature about people, you know, how they lie to get a date, which I haven't gone into. But I think it is useful to think, and also men often have quite sexual sort of chat up lines, and that tends not to go down very well with women.
Ian?
So like, chat up lines like, no, so could you say, like, is that your own hair or something like that? I mean, what sort of question?
That's perfect.
Are they your own teeth?
Are they your own teeth? Yeah. No, I just thought.
You can get the hang of it very quickly.
I've Ian, got you're supposed to chat up people, not actually say what you're thinking. Them, yeah. Say what you're thinking.
Wait, look, I've got a female friend who'll remain anonymous. Right. Let's call her. and she's single, but she honestly, she's saying to me she doesn't know where to find a man, and I was wondering if, you know, if you have any advice for someone who looks around on their floor of the office, and I can understand what she's saying, there isn't much to pick from, and she says her friends aren't particularly appealing for her, she's a lovely girl, she doesn't know where to go to find men. Well, I've said, given her loads of places, go climbing, because lots of men go climbing. I said, or go surfing, lots of men go surfing, or just things, you know, interesting sort of hobby things. And she says, well, I don't want to go climbing, I don't want to go surfing, I don't want to sort of coerce myself into doing some hobby I'm not interested in, purely to find a man. And I thought, well, fair point, but I didn't have any other answers
for internet?
Her.
What about internet? Have you tried internet dating?
Well, I said, just get a man off the internet. Work. And her worry about the internet was that it was full of men who were just after one thing.
And what would that be?
Sex.
All men are after one thing, whether they're on the internet or not.
Is it bad?
Is what bad?
That.
What? No.
I feel like Ian's getting, getting some sort of psychotherapy right now. I think this isn't what it's meant to be private, the sort of thing, Ian. As I
no,
said
no,
to you.
But I'm, you know, just sort of putting sex to one side for a minute. I mean, people can lie on the internet, but also you can have quite sort of honest discussions on the internet, and you can... You know, it's still the same rules of safety apply. So if you meet somebody outside of the internet, that you can, you know, make sure you're safe. But there's a good study from Bath University showing that the rates of having a reasonably long-term relationship were pretty good. I can't remember what they were, but they were pretty good.
One of the more interesting and maybe perhaps shocking stats in the book was about poaching people from relationships. So the idea is, you know, that if someone is in a relationship and you quite fancy them, you have a 50% chance that they'll come to you if you just ask them to go out with you.
Yeah,
so you're
shocking.
Going out with someone else.
Shocking.
Why don't you come out with me? And half the time they'll say yes. I mean, that can't be true. Well, it is true clearly because it's the study.
Yeah,
but...
no. I mean, and it was a good study. It was sort of over, you know, it was actually sort of a global study. And I don't think it was every time you asked that you had a 50% chance. I think it was overall that 50% of people had said that they had been successfully poached at some time. And so she could also try poaching. I mean, it's not a very pleasant thing to do, but a lot of people do that just precisely because they feel there aren't a lot of people out there, and they're all taken.
There's a kind of quality control there that, you know, if this man's already in a relationship, he must be all right, you know, not a complete lunatic.
Yeah, I suppose.
Or sex maniac like Ian.
All right, well, Louisa, we'll leave that there. We'll come back to some more examples a bit later. Love by Numbers, The Hidden Facts Behind Everyone's Relationships is out this week, just in time for Valentine's Day. Guardian.co.uk/bookshop.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories around this week. Here's James and Ian.
News Jam.
Women who are not exposed to sufficient sunshine in pregnancy may be at risk of giving birth to a child who will get multiple sclerosis in later life. Oxford University researchers have identified a link between a shortage of vitamin D and a specific gene which appears to be involved in the onset of the incurable disease. Women are already encouraged to take folic acid in pregnancy to reduce the chances of a child being born with spina bifida. That advice could now be extended to vitamin D.
An American inventor who plans to live forever has been appointed head of a new school for entrepreneurs backed by Google and NASA. Ray Kurzweil, who works as a computer scientist before turning to future gazing, will become chancellor of the Singularity University based in California. In one of his books, Kurzweil, who famously consumes more than 100 supplement pills a day, predicts the creation of nanobots that will patrol our bloodstreams, repairing wear and tear as they go and keeping our bodies perpetually young.
Google Earth has filled in its watery gaps. Users can now examine wildlife, mountains, shipwrecks, and environmental changes in the oceans. Google has assembled a coalition of more than 80 organisations, including the National Geographic Society, BBC, and the Marine Conservation Society, to provide images, video, and analysis in regularly updated layers of information. Users will be able to track the movements of animals in the sea, and even keep up to date on which fish species are good choices if you want to eat sustainably in a particular region of the world. Surfing data is also available.
Rather than finding Nemo, it's more a case of Nemo losing his way. Clownfish, made famous by the 2003 movie, could get lost at sea because of rising carbon dioxide levels. Tests on larvae show they became disorientated and were unable to find a suitable place to live if they were raised in seawater that had absorbed carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The effect is potentially devastating for a wide range of fish populations because many rely on odours in seawater to seek out the right habitats to live in.
James and Ian, thanks very much for that. Let's talk about Raymond Kurzweil first. He's as you say, Ian, an American inventor who plans to live forever, which somehow undermines his quest for sanity, I think. But he's been appointed as head of the Singularity University. What part of the story did you not make up?
Well, look, Ray Kurzweil's idea is try and live forever or die trying. I mean, you know, he has this amazing regime of checking his health, taking all these supplements to try and live long enough to the point where advances in biotechnology can tell us about the aging process, and advances in nanotechnology can actually do something about it. And you know, he foresees these things in happening in X decades, depending on the interview. And you know, it's obviously really interesting stuff. But he's a fascinating guy. But what's happened here is he was chatting to a guy called Peter Diamandis, who you'll know from chief executive of the XPRIZE Foundation, and they got together and decided to set up this school in the US. It's going to be based on in some of the sort of buildings that NASA aims in Moffett Field in California, like Silicon Valley, and it's there so it can tap into the sort of the young upcoming guys from Yahoo and Google and Cisco, people like that. It's going to be called Singularity University, which gets its inspiration from a book Ray Kurzweil did called The Singularity Is Near. Do you want me to tell you what singularity is?
Go on.
Please do.
This is a moment in time when technology, which according to Kurzweil is accelerating exponentially, and at the singularity, basically computers will become as clever as humans and surpass human intelligence. And at that point, he foresees a lot of technologies coming together and a rapid transformation of society because of that. And, you know, it's a really interesting thought to have. We don't know when this is going to happen, but it's this school is being set up to try and tap into the sort of the nanotech, biotech and computing to get people up to speed with all of this.
Does this point where computers become as clever as humans also involve them making robots that they send back in time that look like Austrian actors?
I think there are plenty of computers clever as us. So I think the singularity has already happened and society carries crawling on.
I think we should talk about Google Ocean.
Yes, we should.
Well, actually, to be precise, it's Ocean in Google Earth. They're actually quite keen not to call it Google Ocean, even though everyone on the blogosphere is. But
so Google Ocean. Google Ocean is the as you say, 70% of the Earth's surface covered in water, and it wasn't on Google Earth before, and now it is. Ian asks the obvious question: isn't it all going to be blue?
Yeah, it strikes me as an absolutely wonderful con, this. It's sort of like Google margarine. I mean, isn't it just like, more water. Awesome.
It's actually really cool, some of the data they've pulled together to make this happen. I mean, it's more than just, you know, images of the surface of the ocean, although there are some of those images. Bizarrely. I don't really know why those are interesting, but anyway.
South Pacific yesterday, 321.
Exactly.
Wow.
They've got a whole load of bathymetry data of the sort of undulations of the seabed, so that, you know, if you want to find out where it's steepest and see, you know, the shape of the seabed, then you can. And there's also a whole load of information from various sources on the types of plants and animals that live there, and they've got information on tracking individual large species like sharks and whales and things that so you'll be able to follow where they go. They've got information on expeditions, for example, the Catlin Arctic Survey, which we've written about in the paper, in the Observer last week, for example, and you can follow that expedition as it unfolds and things like that. And then also, particularly for you, there's information on the best surf spots.
For now, they've just put the visual stuff up there, so pictures and that kind of thing. But they're planning to put scientific data up there. Now, there's an issue with quality control, of course. You're not going to do science with this stuff. But they said that they want to use this sort of tool. Their students will use it, postdocs will use it, researchers will use it to share information. So if they go out on an expedition and they collect a lot of stuff, they can upload it immediately. And someone else in another part of the world can know exactly where that data has been taken and so on. The Catlin Antarctic Survey is going to be a very good example of the first time that's going to happen. So these guys, three of them, are going to go across the Arctic for, 100 days or something?
I think it's from the end of February to the beginning of May.
So for a while, they're going to be going across the Arctic. They're going to have huge amounts of telemetry they're going to send back, including video and all sorts of things, which I believe you can read about on our website. There was quite a funny story that I think, James, you spoke to Penn Haddo, who's going to be leading that expedition, about how they've got these, if they see a polar bear, for example, and they get worried, they've got this special button they can press. And I thought, when you were telling me the story, that this is going to be calling in helicopters and all sorts. No, the button's there to record what happens next. And that data is going to be available on the website, thanks to Google Ocean and Google Earth.
Yeah, it's like Grizzly Man, basically. When they get into sticky situations, someone falls into a crevasse or falls into, you know, into the water, they press the button and that records all their voice conversations, which is great, you know. You hear someone being mauled by a polar bear.
It does look it is quite beautiful, actually, and people obviously can make their own layers and things as well. I mean, I think I've not really had a chance to look through it properly because our computers here aren't allowed to download this sort of thing. But if readers and listeners have interesting things to check out, put them on our blog. And back in February also, just to wind up this section, back in February we also had an interview with Ray Kurzweil. It's in the ether if you want to check it out on our archive. For everything you want to know about this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science and guardian.co.uk/environment.
Science Weekly.
Fossil hunters have discovered the largest snakes ever to have slithered on the Earth. The skeletons have given scientists an unprecedented insight into the animals that ruled the tropics after the demise of dinosaurs 65 million years ago. The partial skeletons of eight boa constrictor-like beasts, aptly named Titanoboas, were uncovered at an open-pit coal mine in Colombia. At their widest, the snakes would have come up to the waist of an adult human. We've been speaking to Dr. Jonathan Block from the University of Florida, one of those who made the discovery.
We have a bunch of vertebrae and ribs of a snake that would have been around 13 meters long with a mass of one and a quarter tons. And the snake itself would have, in terms of thinking about how long that would have been, it would have been about the size of a school bus in length. Or another way to think about it is if you're familiar with the very large specimens of Tyrannosaurus rex that have been described in the past, for example, Sioux at the Field Museum, it's about the length of a Tyrannosaurus rex. We think that Titanoboa would have eaten probably a diet of fish, large fish, and then probably a healthy diet of crocodiles as well. We believe that in order for a snake of this size to live, it would have had to have been very warm back then, so warmer than today. So the climate itself would have been 30 to 34 degrees Celsius, which is very hot, and that would explain why the snake got so big. But in terms of the environment that it lived in, it would have lived in a riverine type of system very close to the ocean. And we know that based on the rocks that it's preserved in. And we also know that in part based on the habits of the other types of animals that we find in those same rocks. So we find fish that are related to bonefish and tarpon today. We also find a very aquatic type of freshwater turtles, and also these extinct group of crocodiles that all would have lived in these large riverine systems. If you look at modern anacondas today, they spend a lot of time in the water. So we think Titanoboa would also have spent a lot of time in the water. We also have many plant fossils from the Cerrejón coal mine that tell us quite a bit about the forest that these animals would have lived in. It's a remarkable forest. It's the oldest rainforest that we know of, and it tells us quite a bit about sort of the initial stages of the evolution of the Amazonian type of ecosystem. The initial excitement came from the fact that we could collect fossils at all in the tropics of South America, because the tropics are completely covered with forests. That's one of the reasons people love the tropics, is because they're so lush and green. But the problem as a paleontologist is that it's very hard to find fossils in a place where no rocks are exposed. So Carlos Jaramillo at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, who's an author on the paper, and colleagues, were collecting plants, so plant fossils and also pollen fossils there in this mine, and then saw a potential for bringing other paleontologists in to look for other kinds of fossils, including vertebrates. So that's when Carlos contacted me in 2004, and we went down there and started collecting vertebrates. We hadn't expected to find a giant snake, for sure. And in fact, we were finding many new species of turtles and crocodiles. It wasn't until we got fossils back to the Florida Museum of Natural History, maybe in 2007, that we realized some of the things that we had collected were the fossils of a giant snake.
From snakes back to love now. Back to you now, Louisa. Let's go through a couple more examples from the book. In You're a Man Who Constantly Talks About Feelings and Deep Emotions and Things, I hear. You've got some questions?
Yeah, I was just wondering, obviously you've looked at an awful lot of studies that have been done on relationships and brought them together in your book. I mean, do you think that together these studies actually can really help people in their relationships? I mean, do you think there is something to be drawn from this, which actually there are some serious bits of guidance in there?
Yeah, I think there are. And I'd say it certainly informed me, I think. I mean, sometimes you can read a whole study and think, well, you know, is that so obvious that I didn't need to read this? And you can sift through all the statistics and think, well, you know, are they really representative of my life? But there are some sort of truisms, I think, that come through all the research. And I think one is how you treat the other person in terms of, you know, how you talk to them, how you communicate with them. And John Gottman, who runs a love lab in the States, who's a very well-respected researcher, he says you should always say five good things to one negative thing. And actually, when you think about it, that's sort of, you know, quite challenging. And he also says that contempt is a sulfuric acid of relationships. And I think that's really true as well. And then there's research about arguing, and I think sometimes couples think if they argue, they haven't got a good relationship. But arguing is fine. You just, when you argue, you have to stick to the specifics. Don't drag in stuff from 5 years ago, and don't call each other hurtful names that you'll never recover from. And I think there are some sort of pretty good tips in there that can help you lead your life. I mean, one of the things that I think I used to be guilty of was what he calls harsh startup, where you start sort of yelling. You don't sort of introduce the issue in a calm, constructive, nice way that takes account of the other person's feelings. You just sort of go for it. And I think sort of moderating how you are and thinking of the other person is pretty helpful.
That's easy to say in a love lab, but if you're just angry, introducing concepts in a very calm, rational way seems quite difficult. Louisa, we'll go through maybe one more example. Right now, the economic climate is dire, weather's terrible, everything. How do those sorts of things affect the way that we see the rest of the world, for example, and relationships with people? Do they affect these things? Yeah. Do we take more comfort in them, for example?
They do have repercussions. They do affect relationships. It's a bit different. If there's a general recession, then what tends to happen is the impact of a person being made redundant. They don't feel so much, this is about me, you know, I'm a failure in my life, what's gone wrong, because they see it happening to everybody else. And in some ways, that puts less of a pressure on their relationship. But typically, if you are made redundant, if you worry about your job, people tend to drink more, they tend to sort of smirk, they tend to eat badly, can't sleep, get a bit depressed. That doesn't help a relationship. And it was a study done in the UK, but using Swedish data, because the data from Scandinavian countries is always so amazingly sort of accurate and fantastic. And they found that after redundancy for the first year, there was a 18% increase in divorces in married couples, and probably more from cohabiting couples, because they tend to be a bit less stable. So it does have an impact. And of course, the way around it is to try and be aware of your partner and be as supportive as you can, and to say, look, you know, it's not your job that defines you, we'll get through this, and to be rather sort of loving, I think.
So good news for divorce lawyers in the upcoming recession. Louisa, thank you so much. If you want the inside track on how to find a partner, or just to stick with the one you've got, Louisa's book, Love by Numbers, is out this week. Next week, Ian's going on holiday to the AAAS Festival in Chicago, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, where we did our fantastic AskCast from last year. So we'll be brimming with brand new world-changing discoveries, as usual. Don't forget to add your voice to our ever-lively debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. There'll be more Science Weekly soon.